I'm Hugo Disler from Farming Secrets. We have the pleasure and the privilege of having online Annabelle Walsh, who is the chairperson of Stiper, as well as a farmer. Now, Annabelle, would you like to introduce yourself, what you do, and just have a bit of a let the Farming Secrets members know what you're up to and what you do.
Okay, Hugo. Look, thank you very much for the invitation to speak tonight. I grew up in Tasmania, so my background was off a mixed farm just out of Hobart, with much higher rainfall than where we are now. I married and moved to South Australia, and we were in the southeast and then along the Coorong, and for the last 30 years, I've been helping with a farm called Morna Station near Lake Victoria. And it was very different from a different type of farming to obviously where we were in Tasmania. We went from sort of a 28-inch rainfall, and once we got here, you're sort of looking at 7 to 9 inches. But we did have some interesting issues here on Morna, which took me out of the sort of more traditional, conventional farming into having to think very differently as to how I needed to farm here. So I was driven to change and explored all sorts of different things and experimented myself quite a long time before I came in touch with RCS and some of the organisations that advocate different designs for farming systems. I sort of came around the back door, but once I'd done the grazing for profit course and obviously I worked pretty closely with Graham, who's holistic management, a lot of the things that they advocate and that Alan Savory has pushed for and Cole Sice really just made perfect sense to me with the changes that we'd made here. So I welcome all your questions and just chatting to Murray. Murray was saying he's only just started, and Murray, we're all still learning, that's for sure. I think the more you seem to get into this, the more we realise we don't really know. So don't be afraid about asking any sort of a question.
Yeah, no worries.
You're a Stiper chairperson, Annabelle. Can you just give a bit of a rundown what Stiper is, and then also you might straight away go into that, talking about that test site that we recorded at Mercunda.
Mm-hmm. Well, a little bit of background about Stiper. Stiper really sort of started in the Wellington Dubbo area and surrounds with some innovative farmers. They realised a few things weren't working quite as they wanted them to. They could see that the systems that they had with high input farming was failing them. They were getting acid sulfate soils, salinity, all kinds of things were going wrong. And there were a couple of guys in the department, one in particular, Daryl Cuff, and in the CSIRO they had Christine Jones. And between Coalsite, Daryl Cuff, Christine Jones, Wal Whaley, and a few other, Morris, oh dear, there's a few other farmers over there, George Taylor, there's probably 8 or 9 farmers that worked with Daryl Cuff, and they just fumbled around with different grazing systems and cropping systems, but the thing that underpinned everything was establishing a good base of native perennials. By getting the native perennials back into their system, it was really improving the soil, but improving the profitability in their cropping and grazing systems. So they worked and they finally put together a book. The systems were, the actual systems that Col and Christine and Wal and George came up with didn't fall very happily with a lot of the conventional agency people and obviously a lot of farmers. They thought this couldn't work. So Skyper sort of battled away in the background for many years. The farmers that had taken on these systems have actually been doing very well, but these systems, it hasn't really been recognised at all by mainstream farming right up until now. And now they've realised that these systems, the one thing that we really do, and that's sequest carbon, and we're really in vogue now, which is exciting for all the people that have been involved with it, especially from the beginning. For Colsice and Daryl and Wal and Christine, it's been a pretty hard road for them, and they've really been good. And Graham Hound, our CEO, has been instrumental in moving us into this area where we have been able to set up these trials. With what we've been able to do, because we, through the system, we can sequester so much carbon. Col at the moment is sequestering about 3 tonnes a year. And what we're doing, we're doing a project with the government which is called Action on Ground, Filling the Gap Project. And we're 2 years into a, or 2.5 years into a 3-year project. So we've got trial plots which are just in the normal paddocks that have been, some have been pasture cropped, some have just been rotationally grazed or adaptively rotationally grazed for a number of years. We've pulled out, we'll cut off an exclusion area, just a small area, and we've actually managed those areas to absolute optimise the carbon sequestration within that area. Because there's many times as a farmer where you can't optimise your grazing system to optimise the amount of carbon you're going to sequester, because you need to graze a bit more, or you have to come into a paddock too soon. There's always a compromise. People, you know, they give you times and they say this is what you should do now and now and now, but in reality, it doesn't rain or it rains too much or something happens. You can never optimise. In most cases, you're always compromising how you move your stock around. But for these particular plots, for this project, there's no excuses. They're just small areas, and we've just absolutely optimised the management to increase the carbon in the soil. So that's what that project's about. And some might say it's a little bit out of sort of economic reality, but we're trying to demonstrate to the government that these systems really can sequester soil. And we obviously want government eventually to help landholders move, help with the transition costs into sequestering carbon and farming in these ways.
Annabelle, can you describe how you put these little plots together, or the test sites, and then you maybe talk straight away about the Macunda test site or any other test site that's proven to be proven to be worthwhile?
Right. Well, Graham Hand's really the best one to talk to this about, because he's been doing all the work and I've only been over a couple of times. But we got the project, got the funding up and got it up and running. Graham and Sue, I think we've got about 25 landholders in... No, hang on. There's about 15 landholders involved in this one. And each property has an exclusion zone it's fenced off, and it would be 100 metres by 100 metres. And What we're doing is we're doing an assessment with LFA, Land Function Analysis, which is David Tongwei's technique. So that was all done initially, and we're doing that twice a year on each plot, and we're doing soil carbon testing once a year. The soil carbon tests are quite expensive, so so while we're really only, and I think once a year is enough. And that procedure, because it's such early days, everybody's doing everything differently, so we all come up with slightly different readings. But Graham has done it so much now. I was chatting to him the other day, and he was saying, really, you know, it seems a really far-fetched thing, but he can really look at the soil and look at that top layer of the way the soil's starting to compost, and he can give you a bit of an idea of how much carbon we're sequestering from that visual analysis or visual look that he gets. With the one thing you can't assess with that visual look is that once the perennials are well established, they actually store their carbon quite a bit deeper than the annuals. And that's something you're not going to see. So by knowing what perennials are there and how they're acting and how they're behaving, once you've got enough photographs to match those measurements, you as a person, Graham has said, I'm really starting to get a feel of even what those measurements are going to be down a little bit deeper, it's just one of those things that comes out of doing it. There's a whole lot of talk about soil carbon sequestration, storing carbon in the soil, but very few people have actually done it. And to give you an example, in the Adelaide Hills, there's a property that I've done a little bit of work with for 5 years. We've been rotating our grazing there, and things are really starting to happen. We're getting some nice, we've got, you know, there wasn't a sign of anything. We've now got kangaroo grass, microlina, all kinds of perennials coming back. And I rang local NRM and said, look, any chance of getting some soil testing done for carbon? And it was, you know, they had absolutely no idea. And really nice girls, and we're getting there. I've visited the property twice, and they've gone to the Waite Institute. The Waite Institute have all the gear you could possibly imagine to come and take the sample, much more sophisticated methods of taking the samples than Graham and Stryker are using with their project. It's a matter of, I think, going and asking and doing. It's really getting into your paddock and doing to give you an idea of which way the soils are going.
You there, Annabelle?
Yes.
Annabelle, I lost my train of thought. Helena was having a bit of a telling me how to organise this. Annabelle.
But one thing I didn't actually mention then was the trials at Steph and Warren.
Yep.
I haven't visited them since in fact, I'm going to visit them next Monday to take some photographs. I've had very good autumn rains in that area. They had that excellent late February rain. And the country through there looks fabulous. I drove quite close to there last weekend. And I obviously saw the roadsides, and they've bolted away. It'll be really interesting to see what has happened there. And to chat with everybody and work out, you know, what is the best thing to do? When do you graze? Do you give it a graze now, or do you let it go right through to spring? Or, yeah, it's just getting there and having a look. And, you know, you might think, gosh, there's some lovely winter annuals that have come up here. We don't want to graze these. We want to let them go to seed. So all those decisions get made when you have a really good look at it.
Annabelle, we'll change the subject a little bit. in that when you were at Makunda, you mentioned pasture cropping, and you said something to the words, something like the words, you'd like to see more of it done. So can you talk about that, especially in the country, in sort of countries that, or sections of our country that is much drier than, you know, the Wellington top area?
Yes. I'd love to see some of the Mallee farmers try. Just, you know, do some little trials to see if it does work. I believe that we can make it work in the Mallee system. It's a matter of identifying those summer grasses, which just keep bobbing their heads up. But at the moment, through the no-till system, all those summer grasses just get poisoned, and that's that. I guess there's the fear that they're taking a lot of moisture out of the soil. Bare ground all through the summer, I don't think, an ideal practice. It would be great for, you know, I don't think as if I was in the Mallee and I'd, you know, gone through from the traditional cropping system into the no-till, and there's been some quite good pluses there, but there's still very big inputs into no-till farming. The chemicals and the machinery you need is you know, pretty expensive. I'd be looking for other ways to try and reduce my inputs, and I think one of the ways to start looking would be to look towards pasture cropping. And it doesn't mean you have to suddenly change everything. What you need to do is just have one part of a paddock that you perhaps don't kill all the little native grasses. I'm not really up with sprays, but there's probably a little broadleaf spray. Colchicine is the best one at this, that will come in and kill the things that you don't want, but leave some of those grasses, some of those perennial grasses. You want those to really establish themselves. So those summer grasses are just there all the time. When you've got your, especially in this area, the Enopogons are ideal for this. Once you put your crop in, they're just dormant. If you don't get any rain through the summer, they will just sit there and be totally dormant. If you do get summer rain, well, you're obviously going to get a lot of grass, and it'll have to be grazed pretty well before you put your crop in. Which means, and a lot of grain growers now don't run livestock. So it means you do need to run livestock, which actually can help with your enterprise at the end of the day, as far as your balance sheet's concerned. And it is a whole new mindset. But the thing is to just make a start and trial a little plot and see how it goes.
Annabelle, what I've been reading, what's been confirmed by Dr. Christine Jones and by studies in America and the USDA, two things that they make very clear, and is that perennials take a lot more carbon, put a lot more carbon into the soil. And what they found in America was that in the prairies where they got native grasses, again, they took a lot more carbon than introduced species into the soil. And with Australian native grasses, it could be assumed that they also put a lot of carbon in the soil. And getting on to another, allied to what I'm saying, is that when we were at that Makunda test site, David Tongwei produced a perennial grass, and he looked and he showed the amount of mycorrhiza fungi was around the particular root, and he said that particular mycorrhiza fungi has got the capacity to stay alive for 9 months in dry conditions. When you add all those things together, you can see that that's well worthwhile for farmers to work with perennials and to get that mycorrhiza functioning to get a lot more carbon into the soil. Would you like to make a comment on that lengthy statement I made?
Yes. Look, it's absolutely correct that the perennials, I suppose one of the things that from Bill Gammage's presentation at the conference we had in Murray Bridge was the high carbon we had in the soil pre-1788. And he spoke about, you know, all these wonderful grasses right across the Australian landscape and how high the soil carbon was. And I mean, we've got quite a lot of evidence that that was the case. I think one of the main things to think about, if you've got so much carbon in the soil, I know on our farm now we're down to about 0.2, 0.3 amount of carbon, percent of carbon in the soil. I don't know what it would have been, but when I think it was probably, I would think we probably had 4 or 5% of carbon in the soil pre-1788 in this area. I'm really guessing here. But if you can increase, one of the things that you really need to remember is one of the things with our farming systems now is moisture. And if you can increase your soil water holding capacity, if you can increase your carbon by 1%, you'll increase the soil water holding capacity by 168,000 litres per hectare. Now, that's scientifically proven. I've written it so many times, and I can't even tell you. It was only three or four years ago that this bit of science was done. But in many cases, you could perhaps increase the soil carbon in a lot of the soils that we're farming now by 3 or 4% over a period of time. That's going to take quite a while. But it shows you how much more water you will be holding in the soil. And I suppose the argument at the moment is, oh, we can't do the pasture cropping because if we leave the weeds in the ground, they'll take out all the moisture. I think you have to look at the flip side of that and say, well, look, you know, if we can increase the carbon in the soil by getting perennial grasses into our pastures and into our cropping systems, the water holding capacity will be increased by so much that the little bit of moisture that's taken out by the weeds or these grasses is negligible.
Annabelle, one of the questions is that how could a farmer start? Well, you sort of covered that, and also in the drier wheat belt areas of Western Australia, has any of the type of people got experience like that? I know there's a fair bit of work done at Cobar, but is there anything that you can add on that to help the Western Australian farmers who are in pretty harsh conditions?
I was looking, you know, I looked at that question and I actually chatted to some farmers at Geraldton, about two and a half hour drive inland from Geraldton, sort of due east. And I thought, oh golly, if I was a farmer from that area, where would I start? One of the things you really have to do is really have a look at the perennial grasses that you've got. And most of those are on the roadside, and there's a lot of perennial grasses, because we stopped a few times on the way out there because we were sort of driving along and I say, stop, you know, that looks really interesting. And roadsides are fascinating. You can learn an awful lot from them. And just, you know, start to work out what comes up at what time of the year with certain rains. You know, we've got certain things here that won't come up until the temperature's above a certain temperature, but, you know, the summer grasses especially, you know, it has to be quite warm. And as soon as you start getting that cooler weather, even that late February rain that we got here, we didn't get really, we have very few summer grasses. The ground was just starting to get a little bit too cool. So once you get to know how these plants work, you can then work how you're going to work out which ones you're going to work into your system for what reason. And it really is, it changes from valley to valley. It changes from paddock to paddock. It's really, really getting those observation skills twigged up to what's happening around you. And once you get a bit of a feel of, over a period of time, I know this is, you know, we sort of feel we're running out of time, but it's really important. I mean, most of us have been watching these things for ages, and once you really sort of cue into it and really look at it, it's the patterns start to form. And once you start to understand those patterns that different perennials have, you can then work out how you're going to work them into your system. And that's that side of it. The other side of it is, I think there's a few papers. Grab any information you can possibly find and read about pasture cropping and different grazing systems and how you get your grazing into your cropping systems. Cole Sice has done some terrific work. His YouTube that he did for the Kavira conference is very, very good. Anybody who's going into pasture cropping should have a look at that. And that's, you just Google Cole Sice Kavira conference YouTube 2012 and that will come up. And that's really worth having a look at. And, you know, we all just sort of Google things and you just fly the page. I suppose it's in the process of really doing that bit of research yourself that you really start to learn. You know, it's not going to be handed to you on a platter because every property is different and you have to adapt your farm to these principles.
I'm going to open the line, and if anyone wants to ask a question, they please just interrupt because we're having a bit of a time lag between you know, talking. So just feel free to start talking, and we'll accommodate you. So you know, anytime anyone wants to say something, just say something. Annabelle, I'm going to read out a question that's come in from one of our customers out at Bathurst, and he says, "Hi Annabelle, I'm about to start the process of managed grazing near Bathurst. I will be using trade cattle to return an income, and managed grazing to renovate our soils on what has been a sheep wheat property. Paddock number one has a good body of feed at the moment. However, there are patches of clover that I'm concerned may cause some bloat. Is there anything you could recommend to mitigate this problem?" In other words, bloat, clover and bloat.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's a tough one. We've actually got this problem right here at the moment. I mean, you can get them onto bloat blocks. If you've got a paddock that hasn't, you know, got that amount of, if they've got a good mixture of feed, if it's only a small proportion of clover and they can mix it up with other feed, in that paddock, you may be all right, but there is a risk there. There are bloat blocks, and I have used, in fact, I've got them here. You've got these sort of bomb things. Gosh, I had them out today looking at them. I think I had this problem in 96, and we had some feed here. We had to put the cattle on, and we used these bloat bombs, which are big orange things that you pop into their tummy and their rumen, and we didn't have any trouble at all. But, you know, I'm a great one for trying to resolve these things without having to intervene. And the bloat thing, it really is a problem. But if you've got a paddock with a lot of other feed, that could help. They are blighters. They'll go to that clover, and especially when it's a little bit wet, and they can bowl them very, very quickly. So if you had other paddocks you could put them on, that would be better. And sometimes if there is a lot of green feed and high clover, and it looks fantastic, but it actually hasn't reached its potential. Quite often, you know, as clover starts to go off and it starts really going to feed and drying down a little bit, that's when you'll find your stock will do really, really well on it. Quite often through the sort of autumn, you'll be thinking, gosh, the sheep are looking wonderfully well, and all they seem to have is sort of clover seed, and, you know, they're really fumbling around for food, but they really do well on those pastures that have dried. So it's keep away from it unless you're really going to treat them with the rumen bombs, or I'm not quite sure what they call them, sort of guts. They're big things. They're like a jolly, they are like a bomb. They're about 6 inches long. The bloat blocks will work as well, but it's a bit of a risky business.
Fair enough. Annabelle, what are the some of the results from the trial plots that the Stauffer farmers have put in?
Not fantastic yet. As you know, the sort of we had a very dry. We're 18 months, nearly 2 years into the project, and we got going. And then we just hit that really dry spell last year. And I was with Graham a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, the paddocks or the plots have really come good now. They're looking absolutely fabulous. There's an enormous amount of litter and, you know, red grass, and everything's growing. They're all very different because some of them were quite different. A lot of them have had quite different management. We're sort of holding our breath a little bit because, you know, it would have been good to have had 3 good years of growing, but we really had about half a year and then nothing, and now it's, you know, going gangbusters. So by November, we will really know the results then. And it's being only a 3-year program, it's very difficult to get any real result in that. Well, if we'd had 3 good years, we would have. But that's reality. That's what we're up against. You know, that's what it's going to be like. So it's better that we can factor that into the end result.
Well, Graham has said that he said most of the farmers who put them in, the staff group of farmers, are quite pleased with the results of their plots, and they're learning a fair bit from them.
That side of it's terrific. You know, we find that whenever we go to do the tests, all the farmers come out and, you know, help with the LFA that we're doing. And, you know, it's all that side of it is wonderful. And sitting and, you know, chatting about what plants are coming up and, you know, what treatment would be the best treatment to optimise the carbon by November. You know, some seem to think graze quickly and then let it grow again. Others seem to think, no, we'll leave it completely and just let it all go to seed and graze it just before we actually do the carbon test, because it will slough off, the plants will slough off quite a lot of root and we'll get quite a lot of deep carbon. And that's what they're thinking. I'd be inclined, Graham and I are on two different tracks here to a certain extent. I sort of thought, oh gosh, I'd like to graze it now and then get it all growing again. And you know, get that standing litter onto the ground and get things churning over. But that's not what they're planning to do in most cases. So, you know, these decisions are, you know, even with Graham and, you know, people who've been doing this for years, we're all learning. We really are.
Good. Annabelle, can you give us a bit of a rundown what sort of people are in the Stiper group, and are there any over in Western Australia in the Stiper group?
I'm not sure whether we have any members. I haven't got a members list, but I don't know that we have got any members from Western Australia. I know Dean Revell always comes to our thing. He'd be a member. But I'm not sure who we've got over there. Most of our members are Tasmanian, South Australia, New South Wales and Victoria, and a couple of Queensland members. Yes, we haven't really got as far as the West. I've been over there a couple of times and Graham's been over, but just for you know, conferences or quick trips to different farmer groups.
So what is it? What are some of the benefits that this type of group of farmers are finding amongst themselves?
I think it's when we get together for the conferences and the field days, that's when, you know, there's all kinds of things that come out. You know, it's just a talk fest. It's absolutely wonderful. We have our newsletter, so that gets out, and we do get a little bit of feedback from, we get quite a lot of feedback from the newsletter. And we find that once people get a feel of wanting to implement these practices on their farm, they'll gather a few farmers together and then get Graham or Cole to come and have a few days with them, and then they sort of design some property management systems that will help them transition into a pasture cropping and a different grazing system. So it's really just making contact, and then really Cole and Graham are the drivers. They really, really help with the schools that they have.
Annabelle, how is your property going, and what are you learning from your property?
Right. Well, I suppose here we started off back in, we actually moved to Moorna in 83, and by sort of 84, 85, 86, we realised we had a major salinity problem here because of the way they were managing Lake Vic. And this was really affecting our lambing we get the lambs on the ground, but once we weaned, the lambs were having a lot of trouble grazing on this highly saline vegetation, because you'd taken them off their mums where they were feeding on their mums, and then they're suddenly taken away from their mums, so they're not shown what to eat, when to eat it, and how to eat it. And we were losing a lot of lambs. So we've done a few very strange things on our farm to try and deal with that. And when I mean salty, I mean, they have some pretty salty areas in Western Australia, and it's extreme, and it can be quite extreme here. Our water table's 110,000 ECs, which is three times saltier than the sea, and we're slowly being salinized out because of the Lake Vic and the way they manage it. So in 92, we realized the extent of what was actually going to happen. It's a bit insidious, this salt. You sort of buy a place and it looks okay, and then you suddenly, you know, over 5 or 6 years, things really start to change. So in 92, the government came to us and said, well, look, you know, this is the prognosis, and there's not a lot you can do. And I sort of thought, I was on the CMA at the time, and I thought, well, I'll dig holes or plant trees or do something. I'll try and make this work. It wasn't going to. And after some time, probably another 18 months, I remember being out in the paddock on my motorbike and trundling around. And, you know, we had really healthy saltland vegetation, lots of sandfire, glasswort, and pigface. And it's doing really well, and the sheep will graze it quite well. We had good ground cover. And I must admit, it was looking at a lot of the issues that you had in Western Australia, where you'd ploughed up a lot of this area and you actually didn't have the ground cover anymore. And I thought, well, at least we have got this ground cover here. We've got the saline vegetation here. So let's work with the plants that are here. Let's optimise the grazing of this saltland vegetation, try and get a bit of carbon cycling, get a bit of organic matter back into the ground, and see what we can do. And the best way to graze it is to graze it quickly with a big mob of sheep and then get them off. So what we did, we put all our sheep together, so we'd have 4,000 or 5,000 sheep in one paddock, and instead of obviously having sheep all over the whole place, with our place of 65,000 acres, and we just moved them through the property, giving each paddock about 10 months rest a year. And actually, after I went to South Africa, I gave some paddocks a 2-year rest. But we now have really some terrific perennial grasses when we get the rains at the right time. We can have 15, 20,000 acres of the most beautiful summer grass now. I don't think it's nearly as good as it was pre-1788, but at least we're getting the perennials back into the system. And we've backed off with our stock at certain times. If we actually really try, and if we're going into drought, or if we look at our 12-month rolling rainfall, I have a pretty flexible mob of livestock, and we can reduce to half our carrying capacity quite quickly if we've. That's a really important rule that we've made sure that we've done here. So it's just slow rotation and matching that carrying capacity to that 12-month rolling rainfall. And we've sort of got an energy on the farm now. I know when we got that February rain, everybody else had it, around here had lots of, everything looked fantastic, but Morna just had a different green about it. I know it's only saltbush and there's lots of little forbs and it's not a pasture as most people think of a pasture. It's very much a native vegetation. But it was a fabulous green. I'd drive out and think, oh, this is amazing. So I find when I've grazed a paddock and I pull the livestock out, even if we don't get rain, we get a recovery because we've We really cranked up those plants. They're really working, all those salt land, especially the salt land plants. And because they're working hard, they're actually helping to mitigate the salt problem. And we've hopefully, I haven't done any tests here on this farm, but I know we're increasing the carbon slightly in the soil. It would be very minimal, but it is happening. And because we're getting a little more carbon, we can hold a little bit more rain, water in that top 10, 12 centimetres. And then you start getting clovers and your never fails, and lots of other little grasses start coming in between those salt land plants. So you really can make a difference. And if you can get a bit of fresh water, that little fresh water lens sitting on top of that salt, it can be really salty. I mean, I've even been to Jordan, where you're a couple of hundred feet below sea level, and they're growing bananas. So it's just a matter of getting that fresh water lens, and you can make things grow. You can do it through physical engineering with flooding or banks or all kinds of things, but with the farming on Mauna, it's just low input, and we've just used livestock to improve the soil health and plants.
Well, look, I will open the line, and I will ask if anyone's got any questions. And here we go. So is anyone online who wants to have a chat with Annabelle? What about you, Murray?
Is there a book or something that defines what native plants are or perennial plants are, so we can distinguish between what's a good perennial plant and what's not?
Look, they all sort of operate differently in different areas. Different plants will do different things in different areas, and it's a matter of you getting to know what perennials you've got in your area and what times they're going to germinate and go to seed. Some of the sort of key, or some of the surrogates or the indicators if you've been grazing, if you've been rotating your grazing in the Adelaide Hills and in many parts of southern Australia, you will suddenly find you're getting kangaroo grass. You know, you'll go out in the paddock and you'll think, oh my goodness, that's kangaroo grass.
I don't know what that looks like.
Righto. Yep. Yeah. Well, there are several books that can help you. Let me have a think. We've got a thing called Plants of Western New South Wales, and that's really our Bible. So we use that all the time. In Western Australia, I'm pretty sure, I don't know what part of Western Australia you are, but if you went to your NRM, I know at Geraldton, when I went over there, they had a pretty handy little handbook of the perennial and the native grasses in that area.
I'm east of Geraldton.
East of Geraldton. Well, that little book would probably be quite useful. Also, look, you can just jump on the internet. If you've got a bit of a description of a grass or... I don't know how else you'd have to sort of key it in a little bit, but it's surprising what you can find. And it does take a bit of a little while to get a feel for it, but, some of our Cypher ID days, if you contact your local NRM, they may be able to have a native grass ID day, or there is a in the Stiper website, We've just reprinted the little book, Farming Without Farming, which was a book that Daryl Cuff put together with Wal Whaley and Christine Jones and Colsight. And that will have some of the sort of the tough little perennials that just keep reoccurring in very many parts of Australia. The Enopogons and the Semida, which is your kangaroo grass, and the weeping grass, which is your microlinas. They're really handy grass. Well, the weeping grass is more of a winter grass, but the Enopogons and the kangaroo grasses, you know, are pretty handy summer grasses.
Yeah, yeah. We don't get that much summer rain here, only an occasional year, so the only thing we get is that corkscrew that comes up summertime.
Right. Yep. No, well, we probably get a summer rain here once every 3 or 4 years, so it's probably a similar sort of thing. It would just be we just get these thunderstorms that come through, and that'll get the summer grasses growing. But that once every 3 or 4 years is an absolute boost to the system. And it's so profound. The significance of that summer rain across the dry parts of Australia is just incredible. I was reading an article a couple of days ago where, as you know, because of climate change, we were at 350 parts per million, and we were going pretty quickly towards 400 parts per million, and it suddenly slowed up. This is sort of on a global scale, and they were thinking, you know, what's going on here? You know, why is this slowed up? And they realized that it was just the massive rains we'd had right through central Australia, where it's normally very, very dry for years and years and years. And then for that 18 months, it was just a wash of green feed. And it really had an impact on the whole global CO2 count. And once all that dried up, it all oxidized, and we're rushing towards, well, we've passed now 400 parts per million, and we're whizzing towards the 450, which is evidently meant to be the point we don't want to get to. But these big flushes of green feed that we can get, even as you were saying, you only get those summer rains once every 3-4 years, they're a very important part of looking after those soils. And with the pasture cropping, although those plants, you only see them once every 3 or 4 years, they're just there, they're dormant, they're tough little plants that are just sitting there. They just don't show up there, but they're alive and they're under the ground. And they're living, they're supporting life, so even though you mightn't think they're there and they're doing things. And I suppose one of the most profound things that I was out in the middle of the Karoo many years ago, in South Africa, and this old fella, we were kicking the dirt, and old Harold, he said, you know, you need 10 tonnes of microbial activity under the ground to support a tonne of beast above the ground. And I thought, whoa, that's a big statement. 10 tonnes of microbial activity under the ground to support a tonne of beast above the ground. And about a fortnight later, we were heading over to Durban to the International Rangeland Conference, and I ran into David Tongwe very early in the piece, and I said to David, look, I've just been over and in the Karoo, and this old codger said, you need 10 tonnes of microbes under the ground to support a tonne of beast above the ground. And David, being David, normally answers a question with a question just to clarify everything. And he said, oh, no, that's underestimating it. And I just, for me, that was, you know, an absolute wow factor. It took my focus from plant to soil, and how important it was to look after those little things. You know, those 10 tons of microbes, and you can't even see them with the naked eye, but they are just, they are the engine. And by looking after the root system, looking after those perennials, that even though they're not doing anything for those 3 or 4 years it's not raining, they actually are doing something. They're living in the soil. And the microbes have, many of the microbes, not all of them, a lot of the soil biology needs living plants above the ground to be feeding them and to have that photosynthesization going. And they need living plants above the ground. And with our cropping systems at the moment, we're coming through and we're killing all the plants so that the complexity and the numbers of microbes in the soil are just being reduced and reduced. And ever since we've been in Australia, we have, there's some really interesting sort of comments that are made every so often through history, and especially in South Australia, it happened everywhere, but in South Australia, where they had a pretty orderly expansion of agriculture. Well, they tried to have a very orderly expansion of agriculture. And so they opened up the pretty fertile areas just out of Adelaide. And in 1867, one of the landholders wrote to the local newspaper and said, "Thank goodness the government is opening up more land because I've worn mine out." So in 20 years, he was really noticing a decrease in his production. And they were ploughing 8 or 9 times to get everything absolutely perfect to get the seed in those days. They ploughed and ploughed and ploughed. And once you've got bare ground for any length of time, there's just nothing there to support all those microbes. So we were actually reducing the soil's capacity to grow anything. And South Australia has been past masters, because once you lose all that microbial activity and all those natural processes, and you lose all the resistance of the, you get a lot of diseases in plants. South of the Waite Institute has been absolutely mighty in chasing all those problems. And they've increased the species capacity to deal with all kinds of difficult conditions, rather than thinking, what can we do to change those conditions? What can we do to improve the soil health so we don't have to chase it with chemicals and different varieties and rust resistant and something else resistant? With the natural system that actually has the capacity to do all that pretty much, but it's just a matter of knowing it's a matter of looking at those processes and not looking at some of these technical things that we've been doing for so long.
Annabelle, what you're saying is so appropriate, because this type of group of farmers, from what I hear them talk, are very much into getting the microbial life going in the soil, because they see that as an absolute tremendous amount of value. And there's a journalist lady who's written a book called Cows Save the Planet, and her name is Judith Schwartz. And in her book, she just continually talks about the microbial life in the soil that has to be looked after to get productivity. And the Stiper group of farmers, I think that's their focus, isn't it?
Yes, it really is the focus, but one of our sort of main focuses is to be able to do it by using the cows, by using animals, with not a lot of input. You know, just the right time, putting cattle on at the right time for the right reason, and with the right amount of impact. So it's timing. It's getting them in at the right time. It's for the right reason, because you might, you know, you look at a paddock and you'll think, oh crumbs, if I graze this paddock right now, I've just got that particular perennial grass is just about to go to seed. If I can skip this paddock for the next 2 months, that might, will have all gone to seed and I can then come in and graze it. And then you go to your next paddock and you think, oh God, I don't want to put them here either because there's another reason. So that's what I mean. There's always, you're always a bit of a compromise, but you have to actually start to understand those nuances so that you then have these decisions to make. I was chatting to Chris Hegler at Kachana over Christmas, and he was saying, you know, I never seem to be able to do the right thing. And he's been at this for years now and doing the most marvellous job up there on a property south of El Crestro, between Kimberley and Broome. And I never seem to be able to do the right thing. And the more you get to know about all the interaction of everything, the more sort of problems you have in a way, because you think, you know, I want to do this and I want to do that, and if I graze now, this will be a problem. But it's a matter of juggling all of those things and then coming to a decision. And you know, obviously one of the main decisions is to really promote those perennials. And there's times when I guess a lot of the teaching, and this is probably Murray to be a little bit wary of, is that you know, I think RCS and the Holistic Management Boys have done the most fabulous job in getting out and chatting about different teaching their grazing for profit and holistic training. But a lot of it in the early days was quite prescriptive, and they were sort of really trying to push people really hard at moving stock very quickly and getting back fairly quickly. And you can't do that in these drier areas. In fact, even in the higher rainfall areas, I know Graham, you know, he sort of moved his rest period out further and further and further. And then, especially in the sort of at the initial regenerating stage, in those very early days where you're dealing with landscapes that are quite degraded, they do need a long rest. But then as they improve, and with different, you know, if you might get a rain at a different time or all sorts of little things, your decisions have to be absolutely really flexible, just on a, you know, just really observing everything. So don't get hung up about times and you know, periods of rest and periods of graze, and carrying capacities are important overall, but really, really get your observation skills honed in. And that takes a bit of time, and it's a hard thing to teach too. And I think perhaps SIPA could, especially with some of these soil carbon sites that we're working with at the moment. I know we've taken hundreds, thousands of photographs of these sites, and I think we can probably put some information together that will give people some really good visual aids about making some of these decisions in their grazing and cropping systems.
Annabelle, we have to wind it up around about now. And how do people... The two points I want to make, one is the Stiper group of farmers really appreciate that the use of animals that put fertility into the soil and the grazing methods. So you might sort of have a brief chat on that, although you've sort of covered it, just sort of sum up on that point. And the other point is, how do farmers join Stiper?
Well, I'll deal with the second one first. You can really just go to our website. If you just Google Stiper, Native Grass Association, that will walk you through how you can become a member. And that on that website there'll be field days and a few things that we have during the year. As far as grazing is concerned, I guess the conventional grazing has been to continuous grazing and, spreading livestock right out across the whole of your farm. I suppose you have to really think about how animals graze in the wild. And when you look at the grazing systems in Australia, we've been here 200 years and we have really depleted our carbon soils. We've depleted our soils and our carbon stocks within our soils. When you look at the mighty grasslands of Eurasia, right across Mongolia, China, Russia, they graze there for thousands of years, with their mobs being shepherded on a rotational basis, and they still are in many places. And those grasslands are in some cases in very good order, and much better than they are here. But I must admit, there's, because of a lot of politics and different governance and wars and all sorts of dreadful things in the last 100 years, and also the nomads wanting more sort of materialistic livelihoods, they are starting to run into strife because they're running way too many stock. But the grazing of the herds in Africa and the grazing in Eurasia was all on a rotation. And I think we need to look to that to really guide us as to how we should design our grazing methods in Australia. That rest and rotate is integral in regenerating our landscape.
That's fantastic. Annabelle, I think we'll wind it up here. So I'd just like to thank all the farmers who are online, and also like to thank all the farmers who will be listening to this when it's in the CD format. And we will be closing the lines now. So Annabelle, I'd just like to thank you once again for the time you spent and the wealth of information you've passed on to us. So thank all the farmers, and thank you, Annabelle.
Oh, look, thanks, Hugo. And sorry, I mean, I really appreciate being able to have a chat, and I hope everybody found it interesting.
Well, thank you very much, Annabelle.
Okay, Hugo. Good night, everyone.